About 18 months ago, some of you may not remember or know what we were doing as a church, but we were working through the book of Nehemiah. And for those of you who weren't there, or those of you who've just forgotten, Nehemiah was a Jew, and Israel, the people of Judah, were in exile at the time in Persia, I believe, and Nehemiah was the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes during this time. And he asked for permission to take some people back to Jerusalem, which was desolate and sort of mostly abandoned, and rebuild the city. And the king gave him permission. So they went back and they rebuilt the walls and the temple and all those kind of things, and made Jerusalem a place, a thriving city again, and dedicated the city to God. And the thing about the book of Nehemiah is the last chapter of the book, Nehemiah goes away for a while and then he returns back to Jerusalem, and it's all gone a bit wrong while he's been away. There's corruption in the priesthood. The money that people are pledged to give God isn't being given. They're sort of marrying pagan wives, all kinds of things. The Sabbath is not being respected. All these things are going wrong, and Nehemiah comes back and sort of has a go at them. And that's Nehemiah. And sort of 18 months after that, here in Faversham, we are returning to Jerusalem, but we're coming from a slightly different perspective because we are doing a study on the book of Malachi. We're making our way through the book of Malachi. So that's what we'll be doing for the next few weeks. And Malachi is similar to Nehemiah in that it's the same kind of issues, because he's writing, the prophet Malachi is writing about the same time as Nehemiah and Ezra, other characters in the Bible, were trying to sort out all these things that had gone wrong in Jerusalem after the Israelites had moved back. So it's about 420, give or take 20 years, before Jesus, so 420 BC. And the book of Malachi criticizes the same kind of things that Nehemiah and Ezra do, that the priests are corrupt and people are marrying pagan wives and there's social injustice and all kinds of things going on. So who is Malachi, the guy the book is named after? Well, it's a good question because we don't really know much about Malachi at all. Most Old Testament books, they give you a bit of information about the prophet. They'll say, this is his name, you know, maybe this, who his father was, what he did. And the book themselves will often tell the story of what the prophet did and where he went and the things God asked him to do. Malachi doesn't have any of that at all. We know nothing about Malachi from the book. And in fact, it doesn't tell us much about Malachi at all. Most of the book is kind of directly from God. The a lot of the prophetic books, the prophet says, you know, this is what God says to you. But a lot of Malachi, it's just as though it's God writing the letter. And the fact that Malachi, his name, means messenger, and it's actually his Malachi 3:1, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. The word messenger there, Malachi. And the fact that his name means messenger, have sort of some scholars think, well, Malachi might not even be his name. It might be like he wrote this down and then signed it the messenger at the end or whatever, like an anonymous letter. And that might kind of fit, because if you think about the other things that are worth knowing about this book, it might make some sense if that is true. Because Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament. And it's the last book in the Old Testament for a reason, because Malachi is actually the last prophet. After Malachi, you get 400 years of silence, and God says nothing. Now, if you know, history didn't stop in those 400 years, and particularly in that region, there's the Maccabean Revolt and all kinds of other things going on in that period. It was a very crazy time for world history, but God is silent. The prophetic voices dry up. And the next time there is, certainly in the Bible, the mention of a prophet coming with the word of the Lord, it's a strange man coming out of the wilderness saying, I am the voice calling in the wilderness, prepare God's way. And it's John the Baptist. It's kind of like, so you've got this period, Malachi, and then nothing until John the Baptist, 400 years later. It's almost like the book of Malachi represents God reaching the end of his patience with his people. Almost like him getting to the point where he says, you know what? I'm just going to stop talking for a while and we'll see how we get on. And the book itself deals with specific complaints, as I've said, against the people of Israel. And as Oz and I work through the book, each week probably we'll bring something different, a different complaint that God has against his people. But these first five verses that we're looking at this evening are slightly different. Because there's not really a specific complaint, a specific sin or crime that the Israelites have committed. They're kind of challenged about their attitude and something. So let's look at those verses. Malachi 1:1-5. A prophecy, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi. I have loved you, says the Lord. But you ask, how have you loved us? Was not Ezra, Jacob's brother, declares the Lord? Yet I have loved Jacob, but Esau I have hated. And I have turned his hill country into a wasteland and left his inheritance to the desert jackals. Edom may say, though we have been crushed, we will rebuild the ruins. But this is what the Lord Almighty says. They may build, but I will demolish. They will be called the wicked land, the people always under the wrath of the Lord. You will see it with your own eyes and say, great is the Lord, even beyond the borders of Israel. So these opening verses touch almost, I think, on the theme for the whole book. This book is really about a people who have become complacent in their faith, who have become, in a way, blind. They've stopped seeing God at work. And the way it opens, God says, I have loved you. And their response is, really? We hadn't noticed. How have you loved us? And these aren't necessarily, you know, evil people, wicked people. Remember, not so long ago, they were building the walls, rebuilding the temple, and there was an immense amount of passion and zeal in the city. And some of the people who hear the words of Malachi may well have been the same people who were there building the walls when Nehemiah was there and dedicating themselves to the service of God. Yet they have just become complacent, lazy. They've kind of stopped caring about their faith and about God. Jacob and Esau, that I mentioned at the beginning, were two brothers. You'll find their story in the book of Genesis. Twin brothers. And God chose Jacob to be the sort of the father of the nation of Israel. His 12 sons became one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And Esau, he became the kind of father of the nation of Edom. And these are the two nations mentioned in the beginning verses and the two people. Now, Jacob and Esau, neither of them were particularly holy guys. If you read their story in Genesis, neither of them come out off sort of particularly well. Jacob, his name, means he who grasps the heel, which is kind of a way of saying he who deceives or he who usurps. And as I pointed out this morning, Jacob is the Hebrew version of James, which is my name. So that's, you know, kind of what my name means as well. And neither of them were particularly good. Jacob certainly lives up to his name if you read the story. And yet God says, I chose Jacob. And God chose him to be the line through which his people would come, his nation would come. And now God says to the descendants of Jacob, haven't I loved you? I have loved you. And they say, have you? Have you though? Really? And God says, when the descendants of Esau, when Edom, when your brothers came against you, when they attacked you, when they sought to destroy you, whose side did I take? When Edom raised its hand against you, who came to your aid? It was me. I oversaw their destruction. I wrecked them just to protect you. And they will try to rebuild. And even now I will stop them. Even now I will continue to keep my eye on you. I will take your side. This is what God says to his people. And even those outside the boundaries of Israel will see how great my love is. You can hear the frustration almost in God's voice that he's done all these things for his people. And they just put their hands in their pockets and they kind of shrug and say, oh, well, no, I'm not really sure, not convinced, God. I think you could have done a bit more. I think you could have tried a bit harder. And Malachi, the messenger, brings this to their attention and says, you have looked away from God. You have stopped taking him and his words seriously. And by the end of the book, you can almost hear God saying, I think, well, all right, if this is what you've chosen, let's try this for a while. If you think that you can manage without me, if you think I haven't loved you, I haven't given you anything, let's try 400 years of silence and see how that works for you. And that's kind of what Malachi is saying in these first five verses to the people of Israel. And the question I want to ask you, of course, is this afternoon, what's in your heart? The first part of the service, we've spoken a bit. We've also spoken, the songs we've spoken, a lot about who God is and what he has done for us, how much he has loved us. And in your heart this afternoon, what's your response been? Perhaps you too have been saying, have you loved me though, God? Do you love me? Not really sure about that. Is that where you are this afternoon? Now, as I said earlier, I have five children. I played hide and seek with my children. Many of you know the joys of playing hide and seek with children, and particularly very young children, who in a sense should have an advantage because they're small. They can jam themselves in all sorts of hard to reach places. But they don't always have the advantage because they get scared or they panic or they don't quite have the imagination to see great hiding places. And I have had children who, you know, hide in cupboards and things and have an arm or a leg sticking out, or children who hide in the exact same place they hid last time, or the exact same place I hid last time, or, you know, the children who panic and terrified when they hear me say, ready or not, here I come, that they just sort of collapse into a heap on the floor and sort of hope Dad won't see them. And because I am a kind parent, and I realise that the point of hide and seek is not actually to find the children, I will often walk into a room and I'll see straight where they are straight away, but I will say, where are they? Where have they gone? Where are they hiding? And their children are laughing. They've outwitted their father yet again. He's a bit simple, isn't he, Dad? And that's the nature of the game. But I know that there are times in my life where I've walked into a room and God is right there in front of me. And I say, where's God in this situation? God's not here. I can't see him. And God says, I have loved you. And I say, I don't see God anywhere. And I know I have done that in my life. And why do I do that? Well, I think, you know, there are people who are very stable, very balanced, very don't experience that kind of thing in their faith. And that is fantastic. That's a wonderful gift. And then there are people like me who are perhaps a bit more up and down, who have good times and bad times, a bit more of a roller coaster, and have those moments where you just feel like God is not there. God is not here. God is not here for me. I need him and he's not here for me. And why do I do that? Why do I say that when I know he's actually right there, right in front of me? Why do I pretend not to see him? And for me, it's a simple answer. The answer is that I've had a bad day, or a bad week, or a bad month, or a bad year, and I'm just feeling sorry for myself. And I like feeling sorry for myself. And it feels good to feel sorry for myself and blame it on God. It's not my fault, it's God's fault. And if I am forced to acknowledge that actually, yeah, God, you're right there, and you have loved me, then it ruins my sulk. And I don't want that. I don't want my sulk ruined. I like feeling sorry for myself. But I also know that self-pity is an incredibly dangerous poison. That it can poison your relationship with God. It starts with a choice. It starts with a choice to say, I don't see what God's done for me. To say, like the Israelites, have you loved me, God? Have you? I don't see it. Starts with a choice to not see the God who, you know, cannot contain his hiddenness, who wants to be found by me, and I walk into the room and say, I don't see you, God. It starts with that choice. And then you begin to get into a habit of not seeing God. You get into a habit of not realizing what he's done for you. And then over the time, it poisons your relationship with him. And you stop caring. You stop caring. It just becomes apathy. And I don't know if you realize that God has never been a fan of apathy. Sometimes I think we can think God's really interested in the extremes. You know, he likes people who are really good and he doesn't like people who are really bad. But being that kind of middle of the road, just plodding along, isn't necessarily what God is looking for either. In fact, if you go from the last book of the Old Testament to the last book in the New Testament, the book of Revelation, where John talks about a vision God has given him. And at the beginning of the book, one of the things he talks about are seven letters that Jesus writes to local churches. And there's one church, the church in Laodicea, where they were very, very zealous for God, full of passion, full of enthusiasm. But over the time, their enthusiasm dried up and they became something else. And Jesus actually says something. He says, I know your deeds, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were either one or the other. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. Strong words. There's a church, it should be alive for God. And yet they've become this sort of tepid, brackish water. And Jesus says, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. And I know that apathy, this kind of lukewarmness, creeps into my life when I stop remembering what God has done for me. When I kind of choose to stop remembering what God has done. Just like Israel did all those years ago. They stopped remembering what God had done. They stopped caring. And it didn't take long. As I said, a few years ago, they were full of enthusiasm, building walls, building temples. And then they forgot. And when God calls them out on it, they act like he's the one with the problem. You haven't loved us, God. I know how easy it is to forget what God has done for me. I know how tempting it is to look away from him, to feel sorry for myself, to pretend that it's actually all his fault. That, you know, if only God did a bit more or did something I wanted, I'd be happy. And I know how dangerous that is because it erodes your faith. It eats away at any joy you do have. And you end up in your heart full of sloppy, tepid, brackish, grey water instead of fire. And I know for me, I have found one method of consistently driving out this apathy and this self-pity. And it's the one thing that Israel didn't do. It's that when God says to them, or God says to me, I have loved you, I need to say, yeah, I know, God, thank you. I need to give thanks for what God has done. I need to remember and be thankful for what he has done, because I know how easy it is to forget. when one of my daughters was younger, she went to an after-school club called Pilgrims, with a Z, because it's for young people. And it was run by Christians, and they did a craft activity where they got a cup and they filled it with lots of lollipop sticks or lolly sticks. And on each of the lolly sticks, they wrote someone's name. And then you put the stick down, and so you can't see the name. And the idea was, she came home and said, you pull out a stick at random and it's got someone's name on it, and you do something nice for that person. And when she saw it, I thought, that's fantastic. I like that idea. I'm nicking that. And I will say, as a little caveat, just as I take on the associate Bible teacher role, if I ever say anything clever or brilliant, I stole it from someone else and changed it slightly. That's what I do. And so with this, I thought, this is a great idea, and I'm going to take it, I'm going to modify it slightly. I did not make a mug full of lolly sticks with people's names on it, people I were going to do something nice for, because why would I want to do that? Why would I want to be nice to people? Instead, I've got my mug here. I brought it along. I don't usually bring, you know, visual sort of things to look at, but you can look at this for a while instead of my face. It's a mug. It says "Best Dad Ever" on it. So that's pretty conclusive proof, I think. And I filled it with lolly sticks, different colour lolly sticks. And on these lolly sticks, I spent sort of one afternoon just writing down, this was a few years ago, just writing down things God had done for me, things I was thankful for. So there are people's names on here. There are places on here. There are events in my life. There are things he's provided for me and my family, gifts he's given, just things in the world that I enjoy. And whenever I feel that self-pity beginning to sort of creep into my heart, whenever I feel that apathy just knocking at the door, I can come here, I can just pull out a stick at random, and I can thank God for whatever or whoever is on the stick, whether I feel like it or not. And I have found that that is one of the fastest ways in me to kill dead self-pity, to kill that apathy before it even gets a foothold. And, you know, if you need to do it more than once, you can just keep going and pulling out sticks and thanking God. But for me, I often only need to do just one or two. And then, you know what, God? God says, you have loved me. And I say, yeah, you know what, God? You have. Thank you. You have loved me. There's an example in the Old Testament, David. He wrote Psalm 13. These words sound, do they resonate with you? How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Are those words kind of familiar to you? Have you ever thought them or prayed them or said them, had them in your heart? I have, you know, that feeling of being abandoned by God, being totally deserted by God. And I know for me, if I'm not careful, then I get that thought and it becomes a pattern. And before I know it, it's days, weeks, months of waking up every morning and these being my first words. David wrote Psalm 13. How long do you think he lasted? Verse 5 and 6. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. Six verses. The psalm is only six verses. David, I think, he starts in this. He starts with verse 1 and 2. This, and within, you know, 3 and 4 are similar. And then by the time he gets to verse 5 and 6, he's here. He can't even keep up his sulk for six verses.